we're podcasting. Back.
We are back, and I just have one question for you, Sean. Where were you on the morning of Tuesday, December 2nd?
I would have to say in the hospital bed, under sedation.
Were you under sedation, under observance?
I was being observed, but I was in Midtown Manhattan, if you're asking.
All right, that was December 4th, actually, my mistake.
Oh, yeah, I was still under observation.
So, and I assume everything went fine with your insurance, and you know, you had no qualms, you had no motives, no,
I was not denied,
no ability, nor motives.
I was not deposed. No, thankfully, through our union, we administer our own plan, so I actually know the guy's name who like presses the healthcare button, and I can call the guy, like, hey, Paulie, and then he, like, I don't know, turns a big crank, and the healthcare comes out the other end. So, I'm like less alienated from my health insurance than presumably the guy that shot that CEO in the back.
Okay, so no complaint. And do you have United Healthcare?
Hell no.
Okay.
No, I don't have that shit. If I did, I might not be here right now.
Yeah, people are making it out to be that United Healthcare is uniquely bad, which maybe is true.
I think I do not know. It looks like statistically on a scale from like bad to worse, they're on the worst end of the scale. Like they have the most denials, and they implemented an AI algorithm that was like 90% of the time incorrect in denying people's claims. So like a uniquely shitty health insurance outfit.
If something is incorrect 90% of the time, it seems like it is correct at doing something different than what is.
It's the new. It creates the new correct.
Yes, exactly.
The 90% just becomes correct again. No, you're right. It's like, what's the programmers love that shit. Like the point of a system is what it does. Yeah, the point of the system is to deny claims 90% of the time. So that's United Healthcare for you.
And we were worried for a while that you would be caught up in this red tape, but fortunately you are back in your apartment with your lovely wife and lovely dog, and I'm here with you. I did not expect to be on the mic with you so soon. So this is,
I know,
this is like when Otani goes down with a shoulder injury and you think his season's over, but he's on the field the next day taking the plate.
Yeah, I don't know how much. You didn't say anything last week, right, when I was in the hospital? No updates or anything, so I can tell the story.
Yeah, let's hear what happens.
All right, so I, for a couple months now, I've been getting myself ready for surgery to fix sleep apnea and whatnot. I was recommended by my ENT doctor/surgeon to have a bilateral tonsillectomy. As it turns out, do what you will with this information, I'm very vascular and I have a very small passageway. So when they went in for surgery, I was meant to heal up over the course of 5 or 6 days before my scab came off inside my tonsil area. Instead, I came off after 4 days and I started to bleed profusely. And by that, I mean there was like a torrent of blood pouring out of my face. Was recommended to go to the emergency room.
Your text to me was lots of blood, not good.
Not good. Yeah, I texted that to my surgeon. She's like, oh no, go to this hospital now. So I checked myself into the emergency room and had, I was like sedated at this point, but several emergency surgeries to try to get the bleeding to stop. Eventually they put me in front of this ancient looking, cool looking machine called an embolizer and knocked me out. And what they do is they go in through your main arteries. And they put this like basically like metal catheter up through your blood vessels and they try to get to like the area where you're bleeding and they whack out the blood vessels that are causing a lot of bleeding, like cauterize it basically. Mm. Long story short is, embolized it, I guess is the term. During the course of that, they think that in my carotid artery, the big one in your neck, that as they were trying to go from like one side to the other into like the brain side, they knock something loose, maybe some plaque or something inside the arteries, which then lodged itself in my lizard brain, in my cerebellum, and caused a series of small strokes. So that was a couple weeks ago, and I've been recovering from stroke since then, relearning how to swallow again, currently learning how to walk again, learning how to live life again. I'm in physical and occupational therapy. I obviously can't work. This is the first podcast I've done. Thankfully or not thankfully, I don't know. It didn't affect like my abstract reasoning part of my brain, but I don't know. Maybe
we'll be the judge of that.
Yeah, you'll be the judge of that. Maybe I wish it had, because that's like where all the trouble starts. Uh-huh. It's like all the thinking, like the abstract thinking parts. Instead, it's like my lizard brain. So it's like, do your eyes work together? Can you breathe?
Yeah.
Can you look up? Can you look left? Can you look right? That's the shit that troubles me now. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm like probably a month or two out from being able to get back to work. It's a very trying time. I appreciate everyone's patience. December is going to be a tough month for podcasting. Andy's trying to lay things out so that we still have plenty of good content. But I don't know, if you're a patron already, please bear with us through this difficult time. If you're not a patron, good Lord, I'm out of work. So what a great time to sign up. Really relying on this income more than I was when I was, you know, a tradesman.
Yeah, I was kind of horrified to learn that despite the, I presume, excellent health care you get as part of your union, you still have to pay for quite a lot of this lengthy hospital stay and all of these procedures out of pocket. So it's very fortunate that you didn't have to do more inpatient stuff. You're home now. I talked to you and Rax about the financial stress this put you under, and it's kind of horrifying that even someone like you, who's got this good union job and you work yeah. long hours almost every day, you still have to shell out for something like this. That's
thousands and thousands, you know, of dollars
by no fault of your own, act of God, act of medical mishap, we could say
misadventure. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing too is I come out of the other side of this with a certain amount of perspective on the health care industry, health insurance industry, life industry, life in general. Being in the hospital for a couple of weeks is life-changing. You know, when you say you're under observation, you're fretted over by a lot of people whose main interest isn't necessarily your well-being, but instead their liability and their ability to, like, you know, I went from like a productive member of society in a bourgeois sense to like a very unproductive member, like almost like I accrued like weeks and weeks of time by like producing value. I like accrued time that then gets eaten up by the hospital system. You know, like labor power in, labor power out, like this reservoir of value created now just gets sucked up by this like parasitic industry that then keeps you in like stasis. Like after a while, I was just being warehoused because they didn't trust me to go home. I wasn't well enough to go home, but I was too well to go to like an outpatient place. And then once they even decide to let you go, first they step you down a couple times. So you move from floor to floor. This was at a very good Manhattan hospital. I can't complain about that aspect of it. But even under the best conditions, they step you down. And even when they decide you got to go, you got to wait for like a couple days for like discharge papers. And all these people have to sign off on it. And you're just like this piece of meat being moved from one locker to another. And eventually they apply for you to get a wheelchair. And then your health insurance pays for a wheelchair. And they wheel you out the front door and you jump in a car. And then before you know it, for the first time in 3 weeks, you're back at home. And it's like, what the fuck just happened to me? I don't know. Like beyond like existentially, I guess maybe this is more personal than we typically get on this show. But like being on the edge of life, you know, being in that like twilight zone, like that in between area for a long time is very affecting. Like the experience I went through, and especially in the very beginning, having been through all the emergency transfusions and emergency surgeries and sedation and then pain medication, Dilaudid, and being on like heavy antibiotics and just sort of like in stasis for a long time, it's like you lose a piece of yourself. You know, you lose like, I don't know, like one human timeline is a very thin reed to sort of hang a narrative on. You sort of, your own personal sort of diachronic, like moving narrative through time of like your oneness, your subjectivity, your individuality begins to break apart after a while as you reach like closer and closer to the edge of life, and you just sort of like break apart into a million pieces. And then you
Some people do that for fun, but this was not, sound like a fun experience.
This wasn't like, me and my friends are going to take ayahuasca or we're going to smoke DMT. This was like, It wasn't not fun. I mean, it was interesting.
Did not look very fun. I visited you a couple times, and
and a lot of people visited
me. You cracked a couple jokes, but my overall impression when people were asking how you were doing was not, oh, he's having fun in there.
I was definitely like pushed to the edge of reality in a way that maybe only DMT has done before. Before I forget, I have to give a shout out to everyone who came to visit in the hospital. Thank you to everybody, especially ILC people. There's so many of you out there. There's old friends, old comrades, people who came through, Andy, everyone who came through in the clutch, everyone who donated food, everyone who donated anything, time, books, materials, or whatever. I guess you saw me in the hospital right when I had woken up, Andy, and no, I wasn't doing it for any fun, but if you really want your ego broken down and you want to like see what's on the other side, this was certainly a way to do it. And ultimately, at the depths of it, I felt like a life isn't that much of a thing to lose. You know, everything goes on. You're like under observation. You're like stashed away somewhere and everything else is going on around you. Life continues, but you're just in this little like cocoon in this little pocket up against a wall somewhere. And things just kind of go on and your unimportance is maybe just amplified more than it had been before. And
I'll try to understand that perspective. You know, hopefully it's not something I'm going to experience anytime soon. God, but I just want to say on behalf of myself and of the listeners that we are very relieved that you're back with us, back on the microphone, even if you will be on the microphone less, hopefully that's not the case. But even if you take a little bit of a while to recover, we are just very relieved that you're out and you're thinking and you're talking and reading. And we've done a lot of strike updates over the last year, and now we'll do some stroke updates
too. Stroke update.
But
does that
cap the stroke update for this inaugural
I think so.
Stroke update?
I think so. And now anytime I say something stupid, we can blame it on the stroke.
Exactly.
So that's a really awesome like out. Like I can play the stroke card all the time.
You can play a little strokes bumper or something.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we can get Julian Casablancas on the show someday.
Oh, I'm working on it. Playing phone tag.
Last night.
So a lot of news has happened while you were in the hospital. I know you weren't able to follow
I was in Midtown,
everything.
But I didn't fucking do it, okay?
But yeah, we were looking at there's an uprising in Pakistan, in South Korea. There was a near coup in Syria. It looks like the Assad regime is falling. A Cold War, a civil war that had been something of a Cold War for nearly a decade has now erupted with the fall of Russia and Hezbollah, or at least their forces kind of diverted away from Syria. The kind of rebel coalition has now seized a large swath of the country and is marching on Damascus as we speak.
Well,
this is just a few of the things that are going on.
There's been a lot of things going on, man. This is like a very full news update-ish type show today. And we've got a bonus, too, which is awesome. Andy's got an article. I've got an article to share later. But the Syrian thing is crazy. I've obviously been following this because what the fuck else is there to do? I can't work. I can't go outside. Can't really walk. Like, I can walk, but I can't, like, walk, you know? So I've been obviously following all this stuff. Part of me is filled with resentment. The type of resentment that like happens when you have to go backwards. I feel like we're going backwards 10, 15 years, you know, back to 2011. Remember the Halcyon days of 2011?
Mm-hmm.
The world was new then. We had like a crisis and we didn't know what was going to happen. We thought it was going to be exciting. It has been exciting, but like, God, a lot of water under the bridge since then. Like, you know, back then, the gray zonification. You had Occupy Wall Street and you had the gray zonification, the anti-imperialization of like the left. And now we're back. You know, we're back thinking about Syria again. We're going to talk about...
Yeah, Trump is president again.
Trump is president again.
So, yeah, more like 2017, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're going to talk about barrel bombs. We're going to talk about chemical weapons. We're going to talk about Max Blumenthal. We're going to talk about...
I haven't heard people talking about that yet, but for sure, when I saw this image going around of one of the rebel forces with an ISIS patch, I kind of knew where we were headed.
Everything old is new again. Yeah.
Regardless of if ISIS is a major part of the it's not the Free Syrian Army. It's like sort of a new coalition. There are different coalitions.
It's like the Organization for the Liberation of the Levant. It's like,
but it's led by a formerly or like recently Al Qaeda group.
Yes, formerly Al Nusra. This is why like we're going back to like Michael Tracy territory from like 2013, 2014, because in case you thought like the global war on terror was over or continuing, it is like definitively over, because now Israel is openly, and the United States is kind of openly, Turkey is openly supporting, I guess, what you could call like a post-jihadi organization. Like they claim they're post-jihadi now, right? They're like post-ISIS. They're like good ISIS.
Yeah, wait, they were never ISIS. I think Al-Qaeda and ISIS never got along.
They're nice Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I guess that's maybe how they're branding themselves.
They're like woke Al-Qaeda.
We'll have to see how it shakes out. We'll have to see how popular these forces are once they take power, because it's still an open question of, okay, they can, you know, take territory abandoned by the Syrian army, but can they hold it? Can they govern it?
Govern it, yeah. That's been their big pitch in like in CNN and other Western publications, is that like they're ready to govern. Like they've, you know, Syria's a special place, just like Lebanon is a special place and Palestine is a special place, because these are very like multicultural, communal places where, you know, like diversity means something serious there, you know, like diversity, like Alawites and fucking Sunni and different Shia and Druze and Jews and, you know, all these people kind of jammed up together in this crossroads of the Mediterranean. And so part of what's so tragic about imagining like jihadists taking control is that, and I don't think it's Antifa's place or my place to like pick any favorites in this fucking battle. Certainly the working class of Syria and its organized capacity is sitting this one out, and I think we need to take our cues from them too. But like, I don't know, like imagining jihadi vandalism of like what's otherwise like, you know, an intercommunal, not success story, but at least like, you know, people getting along for the last decades.
Well, you know, in terms of intercommunalism, it'll be interesting to see where the remaining Kurdish autonomous areas fall on this. I've, you know, Alex told me the SDF is now aligning with this insurgency.
Oh, wow. The Syrian Democratic Forces.
Yeah. Maybe tepidly. So we'll see what happens with that. You know, this struck me as kind of another example of the anti-incumbency bias that we heard, because, you know, I think a lot of people in Syria perhaps welcomed the end of the civil war, the seeming end of the civil war, or like Assad's brutal siege of Aleppo as, you know, okay, maybe we don't like Assad, but this war has got to end and we have to start rebuilding. We got to get the economy kind of stabilized to some extent. And something really horrific happened, which is there wasn't any rebuilding. There was just
corruption.
Just the complete the stabilization of that devastation and a situation where pretty much everyone in Syria, even after the major hostilities stopped, wanted to get out, and kind of the only opportunities they had to remain there were to, you know, take up arms with whatever proxy group was in their vicinity. So under those conditions, it makes sense that people might tepidly support some new amalgamation of different militias coming in and seizing power by force and hoping that will be better than Assad, although it's kind of hard to imagine how it would be.
I'm not like, neither of us, it sounds like maybe Gendler is, but neither me or Andy is like in a position to speak deeply and fluently about Syria specifically. You know, we can give our impressions based on the news accounts that we read, but similar to when South Korea happened, I'm like, I'm going to defer to people like Varn who've lived there, or rest in peace, Lauren Goldner would have had a lot to say because he lived there for like a decade or whatever, was part of the working class insurgency there. But like, I think more broadly, it's very interesting times. Like we promised when we started this podcast to pick up these threads, this thread of like change, of like massive change. And now we understand years in that this is a change from like neoliberalism to post-neoliberalism. We would have said it was like the end of a systemic cycle of accumulation maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Certainly it's like into an era of global turbulence since 2008. The whole face of the Middle East is changing right now. And I think that we need to grapple with that. Like all through my entire life, starting a year before I was born, the Iran/US proxy/Israel proxy battle has been going on in the Middle East. And it's not to say that like Syria or Iraq or Palestine can be reduced to that, but that's like the context in which all these things are happening. Like what Israel's done over the last year or so, and I think will only accelerate under Trump, is to try to fundamentally in a neoconservative way, like was done in 2003, like change the rules of the game, like change the Middle East definitively. The way that power works there and the way that, power flows. And Assad being overthrown would be the end of Baathism, which is like a 60-70 year process, right? His father, Hafez, as I recall, won power in a coup in 1970. So 50-something years ago at this point in time, we've had this, you know, power block, this secular Arab nationalist sort of movement that's existed that is now on its last legs, it looks like.
Yeah, and it's been a long time coming, but there was this conception, because there was, in the 60s, there was a kind of a leftist element to all this.
There was,
in the Baathist party, there was a left aspect. There was a pan-Arab nationalism that had a leftist wing, and the left, of course, was always suppressed by the U.S., by imperialist powers, and the result of that has been kind of a power shift away from any kind of universalist or, you know, any kind of chance of there being a sort of socialist vision of the Middle East and towards either a kind of brutal, like, strong-arm nationalism represented by Hussein and Assad, and then in contention with the threat of more of an Islamist regime, or not exactly nationalism, but these different Islamist power blocks, which is sort of how the Middle East is governed today. It doesn't look like we're headed towards any kind of resolution towards this. It just seems like this fracturing will only lead to further wars of elimination of rival militias and the populations that feed them.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Like a resolution can sneak up on us pretty fast, just like this rebel.
Maybe on January 20th?
Maybe. Like this rebel offensive snuck up on us pretty fast. I had left Syria back in like Michael Tracy gray zone territory. I'd left it in like a decade ago. It wasn't really a story anymore. It was a story, obviously, for the Syrian people and the Syrian refugees, and it's a story for tens of millions of people in the Middle East. But all of a sudden, just this last week, it became a story again. Resolutions, you joke about January 20th, but like resolutions can sneak up out of nowhere. There's the resolution that might happen probably violently under Donald Trump, certainly with a lot of coercion under Donald Trump when he assumes office in like a month's time. But there's also waiting in the wings, the kind of resolution that we saw coming from China, you know, which attempted to resolve things between Iran and Saudi Arabia last year and largely succeeded. The question is whether this resolution will be like a Trumpian Israeli sort of neoconservative one where forces are overthrown, where under the fig leaf of democracy, we'll have like a crushing of the Iranian experiment, might we call it, the Islamic Republic and the axis of resistance, or whether under China we might have a more diplomatic route, like a sort of stabilization of the balance of power such as they exist right now between, as you said, these Islamic blocks, power blocks that have been around for decades and that kind of control the diplomatic and economic and military fate of the Middle East. A lot of questions, not a lot of answers.
Yeah, so I wanted to move along to how we started the episode, which is talking about the assassination of UnitedHealthcare CEO in Manhattan, not far from where you were, although it sounds like you have a pretty good alibi.
I got a great alibi, but it was only about 25 blocks from where I was.
And you love the healthcare industry. You have no qualms with it. But
no, I got a guy.
You know, it got me thinking because, you know, obviously we don't believe that assassinations change anything. We don't think that we can simply get rid of all of the bad people and that will be the end of capitalism or that capitalism will be better. But it just got me thinking about the nature of assassination as like a sort of normalized thing in culture and how we get to the point where, you know, obviously we only have our own little bubble, our own little corner of the internet, but pretty much everyone I know has been posting nonstop about how cool this was.
Yeah, you've got like, allegedly you've got like moms in the Midwest moms who are like a demographic we're meant to pay attention to, like saluting this assassin for his marksmanship or whatever. I'm like, so normally I have my ear to the ground because I'm moving around like this city, so I've got coworkers, you know, white and Spanish and black, and I've got people I commute alongside, and I've got you know, all sorts of different ways to like test the vibe. All I've got these days anymore is the internet, but judging from the internet, assassinating CEOs is like a huge hit. It's tough to like take the pulse of things from the internet because anyone can say fucking anything on that thing, and they do all the time. But like, from Midwestern moms to like Midwestern marks, everybody is like super hyped about it.
So here's my sort of theory about this.
Yeah, I mean, individualist like propaganda by the deed, I agree, not really our thing. But
well, yeah, let's talk about propaganda by the deed for a second. Because yeah, I've certainly seen some anarchists respond to this and say, oh, this is our moment. Propaganda this by is the our deed moment. Is back.
Yeah.
And
Shir Nechayev, 21st century.
And this is a debate that's been, you know, I wouldn't say settled, but propaganda by the deed as it expressed itself in the early 20th century was seen by the broader anarchist movement as his death knell, as like, well, we have these unions of, you know, many thousands of workers in every country, and these are workers who are ready to fight Pinkertons and the police and whoever. And then if we have one person kind of going and assassinating a president or Henry Clay Flick,
yeah, and Alexander Berkman type,
and yeah, if it succeeds or not, it makes anarchism perhaps less appealing to the expansion of the mass aspect of the anarchist movement, however justified it may be. And so at least in the U.S. context, my reading of that history is that propaganda by the deed did not help anarchism, because of the repression that came from it and the ability of the state to say, look, anarchists are psychos, they want to kill people, that's
right,
not good,
deport them.
So, you know, it made anarchism look bad. You know, the Haymarket was actually another example of this, where like the Knights of Labor already did not like the anarchists, and this was a good opportunity for them to say, anarchists are psycho bomb throwers, that's right, not who we are. We're interested in building these civil social communities, and we have no place for them. We have no place for the Chinese either.
Sure.
So it was just like one way to exclude a militant wing. We're in a different context now, and this is a pretty anecdotal, but I remember learning in school, in like social studies, that the United States does not deal with these problems with assassinations. Like, that is against the rules. And of course, the CIA would do this like in the shadows in certain ways. There's no cases about this, about their attempted assassinations, successful assassinations. But it wasn't really until 9/11 that there was kind of no doubt that if Osama bin Laden was found, he would not be arrested, he would be killed. And that's precisely what happens.
Yes.
And everyone was kind of cool with that. You know, they chanted USA at the wrestling match when it was announced.
The pilot came out and announced to everybody, and everyone cheered, right? Like the West Wing.
But then shortly after that, or maybe it was before. But,
or it was the news press or whatever. The news.
There was the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen, who was a U.S. citizen who had, I guess, some connection to al-Qaeda. And Obama felt it perfectly valid to kill him and the people he was around. Three of them were also U.S. citizens.
Right.
With a drone. So assassination just became, I don't want to call it legal, but perfectly acceptable of a way for the U.S.
I think if Obama's not in jail, and if he's not in jail, then it's tacitly legal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. right. So you're talking about the normalization over the last 20 years or so of assassination as like a political act.
Yep. And I've got a few more examples of that. I'll try to run through it.
Yeah, no, quickly. No, I'm interested. Go on.
Of course, you have the case of Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist who had some intelligence connections, who was killed in a Saudi embassy in Turkey. And there was some uproar about this. There was some concern amongst fellow journalists of like, you can't just kill this guy because he's critical of you.
But MBS is like, what if I do though and get away with it?
Yeah, and he did.
And he did.
Yeah. Might makes right in that situation. The assassination of Shinzo Abe in Japan.
Oh, sure.
Which
very popular act.
Yeah, and you know that a lot of that had to do with an anti-Korean sentiment, like, oh, Shinzo Abe was working with the Moonies, this Korean cult, and so that being sort of brought to light as a motive became something of a permanent stain on his legacy after death. There wasn't this like heroic memory of him after this assassination.
I always remember him as like representing a rightward turn, certainly when it came to commemoration of the Second World War in Japan. Yeah,
and something of a neo-monarchist as well.
Oh, cool.
But I'm not sure if those were the reasons people were kind of glad he got owned.
Yeah.
And a more recent example that was sort of the first thing that came to mind was in 2020, as we were gearing up for the elections then, there was a lot of concern in sort of popularly in U.S. society about a civil war.
Oh, yeah.
About what would it mean if like the George Floyd rebels and the Trumpists militias like went to war with each other, and there was even a group sort of maybe in between but more on the right side,
Boogaloo Boys.
Called the Boogaloo Boys, yeah. Who were like, and this was a large group, you know, maybe tens of thousands of members or at least posters,
yeah,
who claimed that was what their goal was, to start a civil war in the United States. And as far as I can tell, they did very little of that.
Sure.
But in August, in Kenosha, and then shortly afterwards in Portland, you did see some live fire and murders between groups, including of Aaron Danielson in Portland, and then the suspect in that case, Michael Reinhold, who was a self-declared member of Antifa, was blatantly assassinated.
Right, by Trump, and Trump
and
called
Trump,
him out. Yeah,
yeah, Trump took credit for it. It's right. We killed him, and by all accounts, they could have simply arrested him.
But
and
he
they
was chose, assassinated.
And they chose to kill him instead.
Yeah.
And there was really no uproar about this.
No.
Trump kind of like came out and admitted, you know, we killed this guy. And the implication there was like, if you fuck with our people, we'll just kill you.
Yeah.
No trial.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No trial. Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, there wasn't, this was not like a campaign issue in 2024.
No, it wasn't.
It
wasn't
brought
talked
up
about.
That Trump just killed a dude.
No, it wasn't talked about.
Or at least claimed to have.
Because he was using like his legal powers in a way that Obama had before him. Right? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, among our ruling class, it wasn't like a topic of debate because he was just using the powers that be, right? That exists already that are unquestionable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there is a world where there could have been some sort of inquiry, maybe from the state.
But the ruling class, our ruling class wasn't interested in that, no. Is the point.
Nor,
right?
Nor the media, really.
Nor the media.
And if they had, I think it wouldn't have made a big splash.
Nor even the left, right?
Very little on the left, yeah. Because, you know, I think there were some anarchists I know who memorialized Michael Reinhold and claimed him. But for the most part, what I heard was people saying this guy is clearly fed or something, and you know, with no evidence, just saying it because it helped them ignore the situation.
There's not really like a rule of law left in the United States anymore, you know what I mean? Like there's the Democratic Party, but they don't believe in the rule of law. They use it demagogically to attack Donald Trump and Republicans and Cash Patel or whatever, but they don't actually believe in the rule of law.
Well, they believe in it to the extent that it can excuse them not doing anything.
Right.
And then just a final kind of chapter to this narrative. Of course, Trump killed Qassem Soleimani in a strike in Iraq. And that was, you know, a direct assassination, not unlike what Obama was doing, sort of raising the stakes of the conflict with Iran, like nearly leading to a war with Iran that that I think he tried to, you know, in his final days, hold on to power by making it a hotter war. And he was fortunately overruled by the deep state in that in that effort. But certainly something that, you know, we could see playing out soon, considering all the neoconservatives he's putting in his cabinet. And then, but that precedent, I think, has clearly made it easier for Israel to take out similar figures to Qassem Soleimani.
I was hoping you would say that.
Regional war.
And then also, obviously, too, Israel getting diplomatic and media support, tons of it from the Biden administration for assassinating journalists and aid workers, right? Mm-hmm. Specifically. Starting before even this war, what was her name? Shaheen, the journalist
killed in Jerusalem, I think.
Yeah, and like assassinated by a sniper's bullet in Jerusalem, like 6 months before the war. Mm-hmm. And then continuing, of course, and escalating as the Gaza war has continued with, and I'm still stupid enough to watch the press briefings of like that these snarky fucks and that guy Patel, that fat fuck. Standing up there defending U.S. actions, U.S. defense of Israel. But the assassination of journalists, specifically with American diplomatic support, has normalized, I think, in a lot of ways, exactly in the way that you're talking about.
So where is this all headed? On one hand, of course, I think the sort of normalization and the inability of there to be any accountability for extra legal international killing, just cold-blooded killing, I think certainly normalizes Israel's ability to blatantly commit a genocide and say, like, well, we're going to kill everyone in this zone because we told them to leave this zone, and if they stayed there, they must be Hamas. So anyone, man, woman, child, baby, journalist, aid worker, doctor, whoever, is a target for assassination. And for the most part, the media doesn't seem to have a problem with this, or at least not openly. So the prospect of there being further genocide, sort of the targeted assassination of an entire population, is on the horizon now, is like on the table in terms of these conflicts. But on the flip side, if we don't have a counter narrative to it, if we don't have someone saying, like, well, if you don't like this, here's the candidate or the party that you can vote for, because certainly Kamala Harris wasn't running a campaign about the greed of United Healthcare. She wasn't running a campaign of you've been, you know, the way that they are denying service to people, the way that they're trying to wear people down to the point where they just pay for medical care themselves or don't seek treatment, has to end. What other solution do people have but like to engage in more militant forms of class war against the people they identify as the ones who are killing them and their family members?
Well, look, I'm of like two minds about this. I would never, and you saw like a lot of like based like right-wing populists with their pants down around their fucking knees these last few days, like Dark Enlightenment RX 1488 being like, yeah, well, when I see health, I don't care if it's a healthcare executive, when I see disorder on the streets, when I see political violence, that's when I say no, you know?
When it's from below, it's bad.
When it's from below, it's really bad, right? So you've seen a lot of these populist types, especially on the right, really show their asses. Mm-hmm. And I'd be the last person to condemn this sort of behavior on its own merits. Targeted assassination of CEOs. I don't think it affects all that much, but like...
You'd be the last person to condone.
Condone or condemn.
Okay, yeah.
Because I don't have any control over it whatsoever. These aren't our listeners presumably going out there and doing anything. And if they were, I'd tell them to knock it off, if only for the very practical reasons that Andy talked about, that anarchists had worked out 100 years ago or so. Also because like it's a fundamentally individual acts of terror like this, like Al-Qaeda, like whatever, are fundamentally like a middle-class politics, right? You're like, you're separated from the quote-unquote masses, and what are you trying to do? You're trying to like set an example for them of like romantic anti-capitalist violent sentiment that like isolates individuals as the cause of these systemic problems, and by eliminating them, therefore like showing the masses their latent power. I mean, we've, again, for 100-150 years in the United States, and especially in Russia, where a lot of these debates were happening 200 or so years ago, we've kind of resolved on this as a left. Mm-hmm. But then again, on the other side, we haven't really had all that much to replace it either.
Right.
Which
right.
is why you start to, why you're seeing the celebration of this online is because somebody's finally doing something. Mm-hmm. And why I wouldn't, again, condemn completely is because this is the United States, baby. Second Amendment, right? People are already getting fucking shot. Mm-hmm. People are getting shot left and right. People mm-hmm. are getting shot for no reason. Mm-hmm. People are getting shot by similarly disturbed individuals to the gentleman, presuming it's a gentleman who shot and escaped.
Presuming he's disturbed.
Everything
he's done so far seemed to have been worked out pretty well.
I'm not saying mentally disturbed, but he's obviously disturbed about the state of our health care industry.
He seemed to have some grievances.
He has grievances. He has complaints. This plaintive individual that went out there and did this whole thing, you know, maybe 10 years ago would have shot up a daycare. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the sort of shit that happens in the United States all the time. Instead, or like took a pot shot at the president, like happened last year in July too. In this case, it was a very successful op against a healthcare CEO, who I think none of us should mourn. But I think that this is more interesting for this sort of barometer for the temperature it takes of discourse,
exactly.
Kind of how people are feeling, than the act itself. The act itself, okay, you know, again, neither condemn nor condone. Condemn abstractly, like as like a political tactic, I condemn it. But in this particular instance, you do you, man. Fucking allegedly, according to the New York Times, America's quote unquote business leaders are scared shitless right now. Which, would I rather they be scared shitless from like a mass movement of millions of workers ready to fucking come down their throats with strike action and like taking over factories and fucking overthrowing their asses? Like, yeah, sure. I think that'd be way better for them to be scared that way than scared of like the sort of thing that Pinkerton Protection can sort out for them. But again, I'm not going to mourn this like moment. I'm going to look at this and especially the reaction to it as like an opportunity.
Yeah, I think, it's obviously a lot of what's been talked about in the post-election.
That the Democrats can't do anything about it's hilarious, though, and people disappointed with the Democrats. Like, come on, man, get over yourself.
I do kind of wish I thought it'd be great if Kamala won and this happened anyway. Yeah. And the Republicans were just like, this is the Kamala regime, blood in the streets, proletarian violence. Here we are. This is the future. But instead, it's just sort of fed into this narrative of like, wow, the people are really, really angry.
Yeah.
And that's why we have Trump. That's why we have people trying to kill Trump. That's why we have this guy killing a CEO in the streets. And like the police seem totally helpless, like confused on how to handle it. Like maybe we can ask ChatGPT what to do.
Maybe get that AI that like denies people's service.
Right,
get that shit on the case.
And so the anger exists, the violence exists, the political solution does not. And killing CEOs, not a political solution. But it does exactly what you said. It indicates that there's a lot of people out there who at least emotionally support a more militant phase of class war. And obviously we want to see a class war that is one without mass violence and mass reprisals and vigilante mobs and that sort of thing. But until we have a choice, this is the future we're looking at. It's going to be brutal.
And another thing that this shows is like, despite its value as a temperature check, is that there's no middle class solution to a working class problem, right? Like, middle-class terrorism, whether it's Osama bin Laden or whether it's like Alexander Berkman in the early 20th century, isn't going to get us out of this mess. In fact, it's going to muddy things even worse and make it even harder for those of us who believe radical things to get a quote-unquote fair hearing. But projects like Andy is working on with Woodbine and millions of other people, like good anarchists, like civil social anarchists, people trying to like pose a solution of like mass organizing, or like the ILC, which is, you know, predominantly in New York, but also in Chicago and Phoenix and elsewhere, trying to pose the working class as the solution to like working class problems.
Or at least it's just good to have an organization, to have people who you're in constant touch with about not only political questions, but just about the questions of your day-to-day lives. People who are like in your neighborhood, in your area, you can meet up with in times of crisis or times of not crisis, and just stay kind of ready to mobilize.
Now, if you look like Timothy Chalamet and you have a very snazzy jacket, we're not saying you shouldn't go out and use it. You know, use your illusion. But not all of us do look like Timothy Chalamet, at least not since our stroke. So, like, we have to, in our masses, figure out, different things to do. You know, ILC is a solution. Woodbine's a solution. As Andy says, organization is the solution, ultimately, not individual acts.
Why did you bring up Timothy Chalamet? I missed this.
You don't think this kid looks like Timothy Chalamet? Did you see the footage of him?
Yeah.
He's got beautiful eyelashes. That's all I'm saying.
He looked a little bit more brolic than Chalamet.
I don't know. Chalamet is the kind of it boy right now. So True. Maybe he's the one that jumps first to mind.
Looking forward to that movie. All right. Do you want to jump to the bonus?
Yeah, let's do a bonus. Cool. I think I might have to rest maybe a little bit.
All right.
People have to bear with me. So we won't do dead air. Maybe Andy will cut it out. But let's go to a bonus. Yeah.
All right. Please support the show at patreon.com/theAntifada. We'll be talking about this excellent Substack article from MarsReview.org by Sam Venice, The Island of Eternal Life, about how some of the rich are trying to not only evade being gunned down in the streets by, you know, making a city-state on an island, but how they're also trying to fulfill the long-standing communist demand of abolishing death through pharmaceutical entrepreneurship.
Oh, cool.
And you've got something about Musk as well, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a great op-ed. Just looking towards the future from a friend of the show, Ross Douthat.
Oh.
Yeah, just looking at sort of
I didn't know he was a friend of the show.
No, he's not. Looking at sort of like the contradiction between, let's say, the Muskian elements of the incoming Trump administration and the Vancian elements of it.
All right. So patreon.com/theAntifada. You can sign up for 1 month. You can sign up for free. We have some free member posts. Sign up for this episode, all of our previous bonus episodes, History is a Weapon, and also Discord access.
Thanks. Now more than ever, folks. And History is a Weapon is going to hopefully be rebranded to the Stroke Boys. So look for that maybe in January too.
The stroke affect might throw people now, but soon all podcasts will have to go through the stroke filter. People will be imitating the stroke way of talking.
The better you are at podcasting, the more likely you are to get a stroke. That's what we're learning these days. So watch out. Who's good? Watch out, Derek Varn.